We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Clara Faria, an ACAM Young Person Ambassador, and in today's episode, I have the pleasure to talk to Dr. Jasper Khawaja and Dr. Christopher Begley. Dr. Khawaja is a practicing educational psychologist based in a local authority in London, and Dr. Christopher Begley is an educational psychologist and director of research at States of Mind. In addition, he also lectures at the Institute of Education in UCL. Today, we will be discussing their paper, Breaking the Silence, Critical Discussion of a Youth Participatory Action Research Project, published in JCPP Advances. Welcome, Dr. Khawaja and Dr. Begley. Thank you so much for being here today. Can you each start with an introduction, giving a short overview of what you do?
So, hi, I'm Jasper, and I'm an educational psychologist in a local authority now in inner city London. So my role in my current job varies massively, but I'm kind of linked to a range of school settings from nursery up to secondary school. And I'll often be supporting those settings with a range of issues, from kind of supporting at the individual level with individual pupils to thinking about the systemic practices of school, or providing them with training on a range of topics. And the research that we'll be discussing today, so Breaking the Silence, I was involved with States of Mind and working with Chris during my doctorate, which was a few years ago now. And this provided the kind of framework for my thesis.
Hi, everyone. Chris Begley. I'm also an educational psychologist. I started off as a teacher a little while ago now, and I've been an ed psych for about 10 years. And I think the most relevant elements to talk about today are around my work with an organization called States of Mind, and we're a social enterprise that started in 2017, 2018. What we've been doing as an organization is using our understanding and our skills as psychologists to work with a range of different partners, most notably young people and educators and other academics, to really try and identify what are the social determinants of young people's mental health and well-being, what are the systemic influences on that. And one of the things that's come up in this study and all the other work we've done is the school system being a really predominant factor. And our work's therefore been directed at thinking about how do we work with young people to co-construct different ways of being and acting in the world through research and other different approaches to try and change cultures and systems to better support them, which is probably a nice way of segueing into this project, because this has been one of our main projects and I think possibly the one that's had the most impact nationally.
That sounds fantastic. And I'm really looking forward to discussing the project you mentioned. So in your paper, you discuss youth participatory action research since its conception to a real-world case study, your project Breaking the Silence. I imagine part of our audience is not familiarized with this concept. So can you tell our audience a little bit about youth participatory action research and also about the importance behind it?
So Chris and I were saying, kind of initially, I suppose we thought of the approach as a way of conducting research. But the more we think about it now, it's an approach to working with young people. And it's an idea, I suppose, of addressing real world issues in a democratic manner. And it differs from typical research in a few main ways. So firstly, where often during typical research, you might have subjects who you ask questions to. In YPAR, you are working alongside those groups as co-researchers. So for us, that was having a group of young people who became co-researchers who were then involved throughout the research process. So we worked alongside them to create research questions, to think about what they wanted the methodology to be. We supported them to conduct interviews and focus groups and create a survey. And then you support them to analyze those findings. And then that leads on to, I suppose, the other unique part of it, which is that action is built into the process. So unlike most research where it stops at the point of findings and then you might publicize the findings, in YPAR, action is a crucial element. So you kind of allow time to then think with young people about where they want the research to go. How can it challenge systems or policies that exist? One other key point that's different from typical research is where most research values kind of notions of objectivity and trying to be neutral, YPAR starts from a position of acknowledging that injustices exist in the world and that inequality exists. And it kind of sees the purpose of research to illuminate those kind of injustices or those inequalities and then work with the groups that are experiencing them to challenge them and to change them.
I think one of the things to add, or just build upon what Jasper said there, is this idea that young people, when they take part in action research like this, they're active participants and they're not passive. And that's one of the things that's extremely powerful about the approach, is that it constructs young people as powerful, solution-oriented human beings who are able to, and did in this case, think together about what things are impacting upon them in the world, what it might look like in an alternative culture or system, thinking specifically here about the education system and school evaluation. And then what do you do about that? That's the thing, the action phase that's really important. And the final thing to add to what Jasper said there really is the gravitas that young people leave with having done a piece of work like this, because they've had the opportunity for an extended period of time. We work with them each cohort for over a year. Some of them are still involved now after many years. And that gives them an enormous depth of knowledge and personal insight and self-awareness, but also a real sense of comprehension about how the world works, both politically and educationally, and what you can do as a person within those frameworks to exact change, which is something that we would argue, and I think most educators would argue, is completely lacking in a school system that's driven by standards.
To pick up on that, we know the mental health of children and young people is a major issue in the UK at the moment. We have recent data, such as the national surveys, pointing to an increase in the number of young people with a probable mental health disorder. And given this scenario, and as you mentioned, Chris, this school is a major factor. Many people and researchers are seeking to develop school-based approaches to address those mental health concerns. And my question is, how do you think YPAR can strengthen those approaches? Also, how can we encourage other researchers to use this methodology, which encourages critical thinking in youth?
Something that came out of our project, and I know this kind of working in schools, that there is a lot more talk about children's mental health at the moment and what that means. And there's increasingly kind of interventions that are trying to be developed in schools. But one of the things that was really illuminated working with our kind of co-research throughout a series of projects was that a lot of the, I suppose, deep-rooted practices of the school system are some of the most harmful impacts. So they spoke about, like, particularly in the UK, the obsession with testing that happens from a very young age and keeps going through, exclusions, really rigid behaviour policies, and then kind of accountability measures like Ofsted that end up comparing schools. Competition is built in throughout. And we kind of know as psychologists that this is not a particularly kind of psychologically healthy way or system. So I suppose one of the things that YPAR enabled is to start from this really broad perspective of saying, like, what are all the issues that are going on, rather than just kind of trying to create an intervention within a school? Actually, can we challenge some of these deep-rooted practices? Then I think in terms of encouraging people to use it, how do you make this quite tangible for other people to use? Because I think we were finding it to be such a really empowering thing for the young people, but also for ourselves. But it is so difficult to even explain maybe what the thing is. So one thing that I did do during my thesis is try and create a toolkit for people that want to conduct this type of research. So that's one of our aims moving forward, to continue to support other people to do this type of research.
Yeah, I think that's all very legitimate points. And I think before you even got to those points, though, you've got to be able to adopt a worldview that assumes that young people can think, they can problem solve, they can co-construct solutions, they're intelligent enough to do research, respond to it, analyze, and create actions. That's not assumed at the moment within the school system. But I think what action research does is, rather than what we have in the norm, which is working on children, this works on the systems.
In your paper, you discuss a lot Breaking the Silence, which is one of your many projects that brought youth alongside as co-researchers. Can you tell us a little bit more about the project? And reading your paper, I was particularly fascinated by how the project endured several cycles and phase two, where you led a super interesting mixed method study around the impact of schools on the mental health of youth.
It started in 2018 when there was an Ofsted consultation came out. We thought, well, we need to start asking young people what's important to them in terms of how schooling is evaluated. So we did some focus groups across a number of schools in the London borough. And what kept coming up over and over and over again is how the way the school system is structured is having a fundamental impact on young people's mental health and well-being, often negatively. And the young people could see, and we were quite struck by this, but because we weren't sure how much they would know, but they could see when we had discussions with them that the accountability structures, and Ofsted in particular, was having a significant impact on that. So at the end of phase one in those focus groups, a group of young people sent a letter to head of Ofsted at the time. Jasper came in phase two and three. Phase two was really about young people coming together, building on the letter from phase one, and then going, well, we need to find out more about what it is that's problematic for young people here in terms of their mental health and well-being. And they created a survey and some interviews, which Jasper then did a really good job of analysing with the young people and to some extent myself. So maybe you can pick up there, Jasper.
Yeah, reflecting back, phase two felt like it was a real deep dive into this relationship between the school system and young people's mental health. So we worked with, I think it was 9 youth researchers at that point, and they created a survey, and then we did some focus groups to pin in on what was coming out of those. And what I found really interesting was the extent to which things like stress was just coming out in enormous numbers, how stressful young people were finding the school system, but particularly exams. That was really strong. There was real nuance in a lot of answers as well, with a lot of them reflecting on whether the school system was the main factor or just a contributing factor to this trend that we were seeing in increasing distress in young people. And then I think, like you touched upon, Chris, some of the insight they were giving about competition and comparison that they felt within their school experience and the lack of time they had to explore their own identity or their own interests came again across really strongly. So phase two felt like we had this pretty comprehensive picture of what a lot of young people were saying. And obviously it wasn't a nationwide survey. So then we built upon that for phase three, which was working with a new group of young people to explore the school evaluation system, so Ofsted, that we have in this country. And then I suppose we had this broad task and interesting sort of starting point from our side of things, which would be like, what would young people create as a school evaluation framework if they had the chance to? So we worked with them over the course of a year with sort of weekly 1.5 hour sessions. It was across 2 colleges and all the meetings were online, but we kind of went through exploring with them what was currently in place, their experiences of education. Then we supported them to conduct their own research, where they again did a survey. They spoke to then head teachers, ex-Ofsted inspectors. And that for me was one of the kind of best bits of the whole project, was watching these co-researchers who were sort of 17 at the time, sometimes interviewing ex-Ofsted inspectors or head teachers who had so much experience. And then there were these fascinating interactions and conversations that were taking place, not always different perspectives, but I suppose they saw things in a very different way from where they were positioned. And then from all that, we then worked with the young people to produce their own school evaluation framework, which then kind of Chris continued into phase four. So maybe, Chris, you can talk a little bit about what came out of it.
And at the end of that year, the young people had come up with a set of areas for evaluation. So things like teacher autonomy was a really interesting one that came up, that if you don't have teacher autonomy, you can't have young person autonomy. And the young people were making really strong links between the need for teachers to be able to have some control over what they do and have some freedom. And things like young person mental health was something they perceived needed to be measured, etc. So there are different measures, which is all in the paper, obviously, around what young people found after working on this for a year were the really important, clear evaluative areas. And a lot of that differed quite significantly from Ofsted, which is very curriculum focused, as anyone knows who's interacted with Ofsted. It's also important to mention that it wasn't easy, Jasper, was it, to do this? Doing work in this way is extremely difficult. It's much more difficult than teaching a set curriculum because it's messy. Human beings are not straightforward. Everyone has different opinions. It takes a lot of discussion, lots of back and forth, constantly checking with the young people to figure out whether we've conceptualized the themes that are emerging in a way that makes sense. Very complicated, messy, democratic work. That's what democracy is. So one of our perceptions is, if you want to have a democratic world and you want to have young people who know how to co-produce things together without just going into binaries and fighting with one another, you have to practice it. So phase four followed that. So that's a new cohort of young people from 2 schools in London. And what they had to do, and I think this is probably the most difficult bit, once you've got the areas to evaluate, how the hell do you do it? How do you evaluate young person mental health? How do you evaluate teacher autonomy? So we spent another year, myself and a really great teacher and some young people, working through that. And we ended up exploring all sorts of things. So numerous mental health measures, for example, lots of measures around teacher autonomy that are out there in the literature, lots of other measures around things like life satisfaction, school satisfaction. So a real slow process of working with the young people and then them checking with peers and other teachers around whether or not those evaluative measures make sense. So by the end of that phase, we had something that the young people named the Review for Progress and Development, which is very much based around continuous self-evaluation with schools, teachers and young people evaluating themselves alongside partner schools in the local area, because they argued, having spoke to all the different professionals, etc., that actually local evaluation is much more powerful than external centralized evaluation by Ofsted inspectors who come in for 2 days and don't know the school. They argued that the best way to evaluate is do it yourself. Assume that teachers and young people want their school to be good. The latest phase, which was kind of finished at the beginning of this academic year, really, was phase five. And that was a really powerful phase because the young people had already made a documentary with an artist. That was when Jasper was involved a couple of years ago. They'd already written papers and articles for different media. They'd been in The Guardian, etc. So they'd done a real interesting marketing and action phase where they'd put the work out there into the world. But there was then a parliamentary group raised by Sir Jim Knight, who's a Lord, called Beyond Ofsted. And the young people played a really significant role in formulating the document that came out of that, which was then presented to central government when Labour came into office. So that was probably my proudest moment, is we've got these young people who've been involved in the project for years, who were able to go to Parliament and really assertively challenge some of the Lords who were in that room around the extent to which young people have not been involved at all in co-constructing school evaluation approaches. And it hasn't created wide sweeping change, but that's not how political change works, is it? It tends to be very slow, gradual, and there's lots of knockbacks before any change happens. But I think if we were to pick up one thing that's really powerful about the project, it's the fact that after that extended period of time with different cohorts of young people taking part in various phases, it did end with an outcome where the young people were engaging directly with the main authority in the nation around constructing new ways of conceptualising Ofsted alongside University College London, House of Lords, and numerous other teachers who were involved in that particular project.
After this overview of Breaking the Silence, and thank you so much for that, Chris, I was wondering about also other results. And another thing I was really curious about is that I imagine that going into schools like this and having the space and the time to co-construct research with young people is something that not all schools are going to be open to. And you mentioned that those structural factors were less of an issue because your team had spent a long time developing this relationship with the schools invested in the project. So I was also wondering if there's any advice you would give researchers that want to work with action research regarding this aspect of relationship building.
I suppose there's two ways of looking at it, and I can speak to the actual... So for my thesis, and some of that's covered in our paper that's come out, I was trying to explore some of the things you've just spoken about. What was the impact on the co-researchers? So a few months after we'd finished the project, I had some interviews with them to ask them about their experiences. One thing that did come out was that quite a few of them said it was really empowering. And digging into that, they said that the fact that they actually could make decisions and that they had control over the direction of the project, that was one of the main things that they'd said they'd never really experienced before. And I suppose the other core thing that they spoke about that was empowering was the breadth of the topic. So the idea that we were, in their minds, trusting them to create something completely new and to challenge a government body like Ofsted. So that was really new. And it was really nice to hear the stories that a few of them were saying of like taking with them some of the skills they developed. So one of them was talking about they always go to the head teacher and now challenge them if they think they've put a policy in place and they haven't consulted young people. And then as well, the fact during that year, I think over half of them had volunteered their time to develop this documentary. And that was like, again, I think another hour and a half on like a Thursday evening. And I was thinking about this, reviewing it, and I was thinking like when I was 17, I definitely wouldn't have been using my time in that way. Not that I had the chance to, but that definitely something interesting was happening here where they felt they had control or ownership and they did want to challenge something and make a change. In terms of like you spoke about the structural factors or how can more people, I suppose we talk about either researchers or teachers or other practitioners working with young people, how can they implement or attempt to do this type of research? I think a good starting point is if you have the worldview that we've been talking about, I think the next step is looking for opportunities. So it's definitely been harder for me being like a practicing educational psychologist the last couple of years, but I have been able to squeeze out a little action research project with a group of young people who were at risk of exclusion, which was a lot more challenging doing it by myself and with students who are much younger actually and potentially going through quite a traumatizing experience of school at that point. But the fact that I'm always looking for little opportunities like that And there's definitely ways you can bring in some of the principles at the start. So one of the things I'll often say to schools, if I am discussing with them what their priorities are, or if they've got questions about an aspect of school. So another school was talking about their behavioural policy, and they were saying they weren't sure about what direction to take it and where to go with it. I kind of raised, well, have you discussed any of this with students at your school? And that just enabled this way in to start having some focus groups with young people who were having different relationships with the school sanction system, I suppose, which just started to move things in a very different direction. And it gathers a completely different side of school than I think is like absolutely important. But you often don't get there when adults in schools are often within their own circles and feel like they have to solely make the decisions. But it can actually take a bit of pressure away from them as well. Chris, if you want to come in.
One of the things that we get stuck in, generally speaking, as human beings, is narratives, don't we, about what things are and what things can be. And we're in a very interesting phase at the moment as a culture that's pretty recent. You know, human beings have been around for hundreds of thousands of years, and we're in a phase at the moment where we've constructed together what constitutes education in a way that doesn't allow young people ever, that's not an exaggeration, to run their own project, build things together, create knowledge. Young people are never positioned as people who can create knowledge. They're only positioned as people who need to receive knowledge. And it was unbelievably striking reading Jasper's paper to hear the young people say that, to say that they'd never had a chance to do anything for 17 years of their lives in a school context that allowed them to take control of their own learning and ownership and to actually co-construct something on which they can act. I guess what I'm trying to tap into there is the idea that I think there's an appetite out there among educators to work in different ways. There's a real feeling of stuckness out there. If you look at teacher wellbeing surveys, it's not going very well. And we've got a book approved now to write about the states of mind approach, which is directed at teachers. And parents, of course, can take a huge role in their education as well. And there are lots of parents out there who are taking their children out of school, aren't they? And educating in things like learning communities, home education is rising exponentially. So I think what we're trying to tap into here is this idea that education is what you imagine it can be. And you have to be able to be flexible and change your worldview, take a risk and try and do something that's contrary to the status quo if we want young people's mental health and well-being needs to be met within an education framework. Because at the moment, we now have mountains of data to demonstrate that schooling in its current form is not working. And it's actually causing an enormous amount of harm to a lot of people. There are some educators and schools out there who are trying to work in a more, shall we say, consent-based or rights-based or self-directed learning way. Those phrases are coming more into the ether now. They're becoming more commonplace. And I think what we've tried to do here through our work is just try and establish a really clear way that that can work and demonstrate some outcomes. And that's the last thing I wanted to mention, Clara, is outcomes. Because what we have at the moment is a schooling ontology that assumes outcomes are a very specific thing. They need to be very contained within a materialist ontology, right? So it's either an exam score or a behavior score or a progress level. And what this project does and Action Research does and what we're trying to do at States of Mind generally is say that actually starting a journey without a clear destination in mind doesn't ruin the journey. Actually, it makes the journey far more interesting. It allows you to take fascinating routes that you hadn't necessarily considered you were going to take. And in a school context, it can allow young people to pursue ideas, develop and analyze data and build solutions together in a way that creates much more powerful outcomes. This can't happen unless you can imagine it can happen. And I think this is just part of a much wider movement, this paper, Jasper, isn't it, in terms of presenting an alternative way of conceptualizing what education could be.
Thank you so much for these. And I know a good chunk of our listeners are teachers, and I hope that, well, your experience can inspire them to think about things in a different way. And I also wanted to ask you, because I remember you mentioned in the beginning that parts of the project can be messy, as it will be, because it's a totally new way to conceptualize research. And I just wanted to ask you, can you tell us a little bit more about the challenges you faced during the Breaking the Silence project? I'm particularly interested in the analysis phase, because I'm 100% with you on the fact that young people can and should be taking ownership of things. But I know some parts of research can be more technical as well. And I was just wondering how did you approach that? If they received any training for the analysis bit, and how did you keep them engaged?
It was really difficult, actually. Phase three, what we tried to do is the quantitative analysis was generally okay, actually, because what we could do from surveys is just present to them, I suppose, the percentages of people that said what, and then we kind of gave them time to look that over, discuss it in small groups, and then feedback to us what they thought was going on. The qualitative was really hard. So I suppose within this type of research, and one of the things I reflected on in the paper, is you kind of have to make decisions about what your priorities are. So because we were prioritizing action, it kind of meant, I suppose, you lose some of the quality within the analysis, or you lose some of the time that you might give to it, particularly if it was just a sole researcher. So what we tried to do is, when they were conducting interviews or focus groups, they would often do that in pairs and ask the questions, and I would also be in those interviews or focus groups as well. Following that, what some of them would do is, while the other one was asking questions, they would be sort of taking down notes of what the answers were. We would then have a little short session at the end of that to discuss what we thought the core things coming out of it were. Then in our next group session, those young people would feedback to the rest of the group what they thought the central parts of what people were saying were, but also what was most relevant for them in terms of creating their own evaluation framework. So it's really centered on that action, what was meaningful for them at that time. And also in between sessions, I would give the interview or focus group another listen, and then try and draw out in a really quick, I mean, this isn't obviously what you would be doing if you were conducting research by yourself, but just a really brief analysis again, just to check whether we had kind of picked up across all the core things that had come out of it. So that was like a brief way of doing it. But I know there are other researchers that I've come across since who have created sort of frameworks for doing thematic analysis alongside young people or co-researchers. So it's a shame we kind of hadn't, or we probably didn't have the time to fully do it as well within our project. But those kind of tools are out there as well. In terms of some of the other challenges, one of the really interesting things I thought was this tension between when we as the adult facilitators needed to lead on things, and when we could, I suppose, let the youth researchers completely take over or do things more thoroughly themselves. So it was also interesting kind of in the interviews after with young people, what they thought about that process. So some of them really interestingly said there were certain times when they thought they should have been leading more, but Chris and I were still having too much control, which was fascinating for us because we had got into it, you know, with this mentality that we were talking about of trying to give this power away. But then hearing back from them that there were still times we're not doing it that they thought we should be, kind of opens your mind up to how maybe ingrained some of these practices are. In general, I think one of the core messages that I took out of it upon reflection was that you've got to try and be as transparent as possible throughout the process. So we used a lot of quick surveys through like Mentimeter to check in with them and check they were happy with the direction that things were going in, or check that they were happy with the research questions that we developed. But what you sometimes get into through that process is, like Chris talked about, it gets really messy. So what do you do when three co-researchers say they're not happy, but the rest of them say they are? So we try to be really accommodating of that. And sometimes I would go off in a separate little group with those young people to try and fine tune the bits that they were uncomfortable with. But it does mean ultimately it comes back to this question of time, and that you don't know where it's going to go. You don't know how much time you're going to need to have for different parts of the project. So it is really hard to structure. And what Chris and I ended up doing is, we, in between our weekly sessions, we would have a catch up, try and draw together where the core elements were, think about what the young people said, where they wanted to go next, and put together a kind of rough schedule for the next session. But sometimes it would get to a point where we were like, okay, we're halfway through the year, we really need to start kind of talking to some people now or arranging the interviews, which brings with it loads of challenges. But Chris, you can add more.
It's much more difficult than traditional status quo teaching. And it's constant deliberation, Jasper, isn't it? Where you're every session trying to make sure that you're not maneuvering what you perceive to be the themes that are emerging from the conversations in a direction that you've chosen rather than participants have. And also, the idea is that we're all co-researchers together. So keeping in mind that those sort of decision-making processes need to always be at the front of your mind is a challenge. You know, it's not something that we're habituated to doing through our own schooling or even our own educations at university level, is it? It's often quite hierarchical. And for me, that's the greatest challenge. And the only other challenge I think there is just around people's capacity to actually understand what that process looks like, even in their own minds, before you start. So if I'm a classroom teacher, for example, I'm very aware that there's not really a coherent framework or set of training protocols to deliver action research, is there? You know, so it would take some time for an educator wishing to do this to really engage with the approach and try and understand what the challenges are going to be and then take it from there. But I think just to flip that on its head, I'm sure Jasper would agree that when teachers do take part in this work and they are able to pull it off, and we've worked with a lot of teachers throughout the last sort of 5 or 6 years, it's really transformative for them because they're then working in a way that they probably came into the profession wishing to do, which is to work co-productively with young people. So yeah, I think it's really important to understand the challenges though before we go into it.
Well, thank you so much for such an interesting discussion today. And to wrap up, can you tell us a little bit more about what are your hopes for the future regarding action research? And I think, well, the current educational system, as those things are very interlinked, where would you like to see the field going?
I guess for me as a starting point, and it has been really nice since doing the research when people have reached out to me and said they're interested in doing some action research. But I think just this idea that it is possible as a starting point and just seeing more and more people do it, I think would be quite a powerful thing just in different ways to really build this network where we can learn from each other. And that's something like I learned trying to do it last year in a different context with much less time, is it kind of flags up all these challenges further. And often projects raise more questions or you can raise more insights. So having a group of people that were all kind of passionate about this type of work or using these principles would be such a great starting point. And I think seeing more people actually do it or use these ideas starts to create more possibilities, I think. When you see it in the fringes, it starts to make it more possible, and more people can start to see that some of these ideas can work and be really empowering. So that's kind of where I'd like to see things move, say, in the near future. Just more people using it, more people thinking it's possible, and from there, hopefully more opportunities, more possibilities arise.
Just to build on that, I think I really see action research with young people as part of a broader scheme of change in the education and mental health and research climate. We've had for a number of years now this idea of pupil voice, which only really became common parlance in the 1980s. And before that, there was no sense whatsoever that young people should take any part in their education other than to listen, retain, and do exams. So we're gradually moving, I think, as a society into a place where there's a growing recognition that if you want young people to get to 18 years old or however old they are when they leave school, able to take on problems, deeply comprehend them and do something really meaningful, they have to practice it. And if they never practice it, of course, by the time they get to university, and we hear this often in university from other university lecturers, they don't know how to think critically very well because they haven't had any practice. But I think for me, it's part of a scheme in terms of revitalizing our understanding of what people are and what mental health is. And that's a core element of the journal that it's gone into, isn't it? And also thinking more about the academic literature and how to align it. What's absolutely clear is if you use an action research approach or similar, that's far more fruitful in terms of building the mental health and well-being of human beings who are subject to it, because they're active participants, so they have autonomy. They can engage with the project in ways that make them feel competent. So, for example, some young people opted to talk about this work at various different conferences, both nationally and internationally. Some of the young people much preferred to be in the background, not even to appear on the documentary. But some of those young people were extremely good at formulating stuff, Jasper, weren't they? Writing things down. I'm thinking of a couple of them in my mind who are really good at different elements of the project. So you can sort of help young people to direct their energies in ways that make them feel competent and intelligent. It builds an enormous sense of belonging. And what we know about the literature on belongingness is Alan and colleagues led a paper into the world recently that suggested 1 in 4 young people in schools don't perceive belonging. And if you look at what that means, that's potentially catastrophic for mental health and well-being of young people if they don't perceive that they belong in the school environment. If you take a sort of action research approach, you build a really strong sense of relatedness within that group. It's safe, it's secure. It's a place where people are really building things together in a really meaningful way. And it's a very authentic way of practicing. So I think it's part of understanding about how education can genuinely become democratic and responsive to young people. But I think it can also be part of different ways of being and acting in the education context that really promote young people's mental health and well-being in ways that are currently not occurring. And that might be an interesting sort of way to round it off.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Jasper, and thank you so much, Chris, for sharing your research and your vision with us. And for more details, both on Dr. Khawaja and Dr. Bagley's work, you can visit the ACAM website, which is www.acam.org, and also their websites, which will be linked in the page of this podcast. Do keep an eye out for other podcasts in the In Conversation series, and don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or a review, and do share it with your friends and colleagues.